Hey, everybody, this is Paul Boyer. You're listening to the Mad Money Machine, and I've been away for a long time, away from the microphone at least. Been doing a whole lot of golfing this summer, trying to get my handicap down a little bit. I haven't had a whole lot of new information to convey to you, so why do a show if I don't have anything to say? And I've been reading Atlas Shrugged, but now... I'm back in the saddle. Yeah, there was something, I don't know, it was kind of like writer's block or podcaster's block. This book that I started back in March, I think it was, of this year. And if you remember, I took it to the beach with me and read one page, exactly one page of it while sitting on the beach. Atlas Shrugged. Oh my goodness. Felt like I was taking a college course, you know, trying to get through this book. Not a pleasant read. I would say that it is appropriate to our times, though, what's going on in the book. The looters have taken over the world, and the producers decide to go on strike against the looters. And it's kind of what's happening in today's world, don't you think? I don't know that we've got a whole lot of people going on strike, necessarily. But I did have the idea a couple of months ago. I was thinking, what? Wouldn't it be great if we could carve out a little piece of land in the country somewhere? I don't know, maybe where there aren't a whole lot of people already. Figure, what, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho. Carve out some good property. Put a big line around it and call that a federal free zone. In other words, declare a declaration of independence from oppressive government and, you know, start with a clean slate. Don't have an IRS, don't have all the regulations on businesses and things, and then try to develop a society that's more focused on liberty than on tyranny. And I was thinking about this podcast and what I should say, and I know nobody's interested in me talking about golf on this show, so I won't talk up too much about it on this show. What I will talk about is the lazy portfolios. Let me give you a little bit of a recent performance update on the lazy portfolios. You can find out the composition of these portfolios by going to madmoneymachine.com and clicking on the portfolios link. And clicking on some further links inside there. So let's give you a little performance update. Year to date and 2008 to date, if you get what I mean. So up until October the 13th, through the 13th, the year to date performance for the lazy portfolios has been pretty high. I think the highest performing of the lazy portfolios this year to date is the IFA Index Portfolio 100 Bright Red, up 36.2% in 2009. But in 2008, that portfolio was down 40.6%. So, how much is it up or down since the beginning of last year, since the beginning of 2008? Now, if you combine the two, if you calculate it up properly, if you go back using the spreadsheet that I've gotten, including dividends and reinvested and all this, we come to a number about minus 20% so far for the past 22 months. Down 20% for the past 22 months. That is that's the best performing fund for this year to date, and probably was the worst performing of the lazy portfolios, except for I'm looking at MMM Smiler funds, which is nearly the same composition. It was down 40.9% in 2008, down 22.1% for the 22 months. Which portfolio did the best over the 22-month period? The Harry Brown Permanent Portfolio. 22 months record is up 5.1%. Year-to-date record, 2009, it's up 6.9%. And then last year, when every other lazy portfolio was down more than 15.9%, it was up 1.4%. And why is that? Well, because it holds a quarter of its portfolio in gold, it holds a quarter in cash, a quarter in long-term bonds, and a quarter in the entire U.S. stock market. So most of the other lazy portfolios are entirely stock market oriented. And you can tell then that the risk of the other portfolios is much higher. And that's really what we should be focusing on there, is the risk that the investment is undertaking. So that's a little bit of an update. I'm going to post a table showing all, what are the 29? I think there's 29 of these lazy portfolios. All of their year-to-date performance, their 2008 performance, and then their combined 22-month performance. You can see that at madmoneymachine.com/portfolios. So I haven't been doing a show in a long while. I do appreciate your emails to me asking me what's going on. And some of you encouraged me to put out some more shows. Some of you just said, is that the end? I guess, you know, maybe they're kind of hoping, is that the end, please? Well, I am still here. I'll give you some excuses why I haven't been at the microphone. Number one, motivation, or the lack thereof, obviously. And thinking of it in economic terms, not financial, not necessarily monetary terms, but just economic terms, you know, incentives. What has been my incentive to do a show? I haven't had a whole lot of new information to convey, so that's a disincentive for me to do a show. I come to the idea that if I say something wrong, I'll get more people angry than if I say something right, I'll get people happy. So I'm almost at this point where I've got more of a fear of doing something wrong than I have of a anticipation of doing something right at this point. And as I mentioned, another excuse I have is I wanted to finish this crazy book, Atlas Shrugged. You know, so every time I would think about doing a show, I would say, well, let me just read a little bit more of this book and try to get this thing done. And in fact, I think there's a passage of the book. I'll have to decide if I'm going to read it to you later in the show. I've remembered I remembered the page number of the passage, and I think I want to read that to you. And then, of course, golf and sport and summer and warm temperatures and not wanting to sit in my office inside behind the microphone doing the show. So those are all the excuses. One of the things I was thinking of to tell you is my sources of information, so that when I do have information, this is where I get it from. And when I don't have information, you can go and get it yourself. I like the ticker guy, Brian Deninger. Boy, I hope I remembered his name right. And I think I read his blog regularly, even though I don't read all the words in the blog. I kind of read the beginning paragraphs and skim it and read the conclusions. He is one of the more pessimistic bloggers/amateur economists. Out there. He's very pessimistic on the banks and the banking system. And I'd encourage you to read the Ticker Guy's blog. Let's see if I can get a little bit better website for you on that. Market Ticker and market-ticker.org is where you can read his postings. And I've subscribed to it in Google Reader is the technique I use to read that. I also look at Mike Shedlock's blog, which is called Mish's Global Economic Trend Analysis. He is also somewhat pessimistic on the economy. Now, what has been interesting earlier this month is these guys had a battle of words. Mish is most decidedly in the anti-fractional reserve banking camp, whereas Ticker Guy says that fractional reserve banking doesn't make a difference. And if you've been following the libertarian viewpoint, they say fractional reserve banking is evil. It creates money out of thin air. Every deposit that's made into a bank lends out 9 times the amount in money, creates that amount of money. But Ticker Guy says, yes, but the money is backed by something. It's not like you're creating money against nothing. You're creating money against some asset that you're loaning the money against. So, in other words, someone takes out a loan for a home that's worth $300,000. They get the $300,000, but the bank has the piece of paper that says we own the $300,000 house, you know, supposedly. And that has been the big problem, of course, is with house prices having come down a lot, these banks are holding lots of pieces of paper that aren't worth as much as what they once were. And the Ticker Guy says this is kicking out the underpinnings of the economic system. I also listened to the No Agenda podcast with Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak. Adam Curry has also come to somewhat of an enlightenment, somewhat of an awakening. He's become somewhat of aware of all the grand schemes around him. And he has come to educate John C. Dvorak, I think, on a lot of these grand schemes. And therefore, Dvorak has become much more pessimistic. You know, I guess maybe I should turn CNBC back on, because they're always optimistic, and just get the consensus viewpoint to the economic system. I don't know. Maybe after some nearly half century of being bathed in perpetual optimism, it's been a time that I've been due for some pessimism and some other alternative viewpoints. And which is another reason why I haven't done this show, is because when I started out doing the Mad Money Machine, I was mostly in the consensus viewpoint, mostly still asleep to the grand schemes of the ways of the world. And it's easy to talk to the large population about happiness and optimism. It's easy to do. But if you become pessimistic about certain things, then you're looked at as a kind of a kook, a lunatic, a doomsday sayer, you know, someone just trying to get attention for spouting, anticipating bad news. And it got me to thinking about The Matrix, the movie The Matrix. And I hope you've seen it. I've watched it several times, and I think I'll watch it again soon. Neo, the protagonist, played by Keanu Reeves, he awakens during the movie. He discovers that the world that he's been involved in is all a hoax. It's all a computer-generated world made to look pretty and optimistic and real. And it turns out that there's a more real world out there, a world of liberty instead of a world of tyranny. But I got to thinking, Neo didn't have any, I may get this wrong, but I don't think Neo had any friends or family in The Matrix. He had friends or family in the real world, where the little inner Earth spaceship resides, you know, Zion and all that. But he didn't have any friends or family in The Matrix that he had to tell them about his awakening. He didn't have to describe for them what is the real world, and then have them be in judgment of him as some kind of a kook. What are you talking about? They would say, you're so pessimistic about the world. There's no such thing as an underworld colony. There's no such thing as the Matrix, they might say to Neo. And he didn't have a podcast that he would broadcast to several thousand people around the world his awakening. So that is perhaps one of the reasons why I have been on hiatus for a while. And listening to No Agenda, listening to Ticker Guy, reading Mish's Global Economic Analysis. And also LouRockwell.com. LouRockwell.com is a source for information, I'd say unconventional information, that goes beyond the bounds of just economics and just politics even. If you actually read his columnists, they talk about all kinds of things, you know, health issues, nutrition, dentistry, automobiles, old movies, all kinds of really unconventional ideas that you won't find really anywhere else, I think, on the internet. And I highly recommend those sources of information to you. All right, so I promised I was going to read a passage from Atlas Shrugged. And coincidentally enough, it's around page 411. 411, the number you dial for information. This is a section where Francisco talks about money. He's talking with Reardon. And it's a rather lengthy passage. So bear with me. "So you think that money is the root of all evil?" said Francisco D'Anconia. "Have you ever asked, what is the root of money? Money is a tool of exchange, which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers who claim your product by tears, or of the looters who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce. Is that what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It's not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor, your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you there are men who will not default on that moral principle which is the root of money. Is that what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by men who had discovered it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. But you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak? What strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of the fools? By the able at the expense of the incompetent? By the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made before it can be looted or mooched. Made by the effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is the one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not for their loss, the recognition that they are not beasts of burden born to carry the weight of your misery, that you must offer them values, not wounds, that the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell, not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy not the shoddiest they offer, but the best that your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force, as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and highest ability. And the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence whose tool and symbol is money. Is that what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not buy happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value. And it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him, with his money replacing his judgment, ends up by becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and the frauds come flocking to him, drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth, the man who would make his own fortune no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him. Did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should be distributed among you, loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one, would not bring back the dead virtue which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve the mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Well, I'm going to leave off there. I think that's long enough. But his preaching goes on for 1, 2, 3, 4, well, about three more pages. But that's nothing compared to the, what was it, 3-hour long talk near the end of the book that I had to, what do they call it? It's a real page turner. That part of the book was a real page turner. And I was flipping pages without reading them. But Atlas Shrugged. A lot's in there, a lot about the battle of liberty versus tyranny, the battle of centralized control versus very much distributed lack of control, you know, the market forces. So if there's a Reader's Digest version of Atlas Shrugged somewhere, I recommend you pick it up and get that. The unabridged version is a little bit tedious. Recently became aware of that I do recommend that you read, and it's very easily digestible. 35, 34 little bite-sized chapters. I'd say if you get a copy of the book, you know, put it in your bathroom and on the throne there and read a chapter a day. But the book is actually available free on the internet. And so unless you take your laptop into the throne room, or maybe you've got a Kindle that you can put the PDF file on, I recommend you get a copy of Inclined to Liberty and read it. Chapter 10 is called Wealth Begets Wealth, and it fits right in with the theme that I just read from Atlas Shrugged in this book written by Louis Carabini. He says in Chapter 10, Wealth Begets Wealth, those who earn wealth by producing goods and services that others choose to purchase have freed multitudes from the miseries that nature would have otherwise bestowed upon them. To earn wealth, one must offer goods and services that others consider more valuable than the price at which those goods and services are being offered. One who produces and sells a million widgets to a million different people at a $1 profit per widget become a millionaire. But each of the million people who buys that product gains, through the purchase of a widget, something greater than its cost. Why? Well, if the value of the widget were not considered greater than what was paid for it, then the buyer would not have purchased the widget. The amount of gain is individually subjective, but if each purchaser perceives the added benefit of the purchase to be at least $1, all purchasers as a group would have gained at least $1 million in wealth. Because the earning of wealth in free markets is dependent upon those who perceive value in the earner's goods and services, the greater the wealth earned by one necessitates the greater the perceived wealth or well-being gained by another. This is necessary bilateral gain in wealth. This necessary bilateral gain in wealth also applies to the exchange of labor and wages. The value of one's labor is worth less than the wages to the employee and more than the wages to the employer. Thus, both the employee and employer are wealthier with the exchange than without the exchange. Of course, values at the time of an exchange may not always turn out to be as originally perceived. Buying a car that turns out to be a lemon, regretting the purchase of that last drink, buying a stock that later plummets, or taking a job that is less rewarding than originally thought are all examples of this. Nevertheless, at the time of a voluntary exchange, each party perceives the exchange as a gain in well-being. When we visualize money flowing from one person to another, we tend to focus on the gain of the seller, not the gain of the buyer. Even governments seem to focus on the gain of the seller by reporting a negative balance of trade for the country that buys goods from a foreign country and a positive balance of trade when it sells goods to them. Yet when we personally buy something, a new car, say, or a computer, or a suit, or a dress, we're more excited about the purchase we've made than about the money we used to have that made the purchase. The very word trade implies a voluntary exchange, and therefore a resulting positive for each side of the transaction. Reported U.S. trade imbalances of deficits and surpluses are fictitious, since no trade would have occurred if either party saw that trade was a deficit. only by failing to account for all transfers of money for services and investments among trading entities can one fabricate an imbalance of trade. If I buy a loaf of bread from the grocer across the street, we would not call it an imbalance of trade. That is a positive for the grocer and a negative for me. However, if the street were the border between the U.S. and Canada, my purchase would be considered a deficit for the U.S. and a surplus for Canada in a balance of trade calculation. I'm going to have a link to this book, Inclined to Liberty. And you can read all 35 chapters. Chapter 1, Why Write This Book? Chapter 11, Money. What is it? Chapter 12, Money is Not Prosperity. Chapter 13, Meaningless Earning Gaps. And a lot more. Highly, highly recommended. Put a Mad Money Machine under my belt. That should hold off some emails for a while. And it should hold me for a while. I'll let you know that I'm still here. And if I come across any information in the next few weeks, months, or for the rest of 2009, I will pass it along to you on this channel. I'm Paul Boyer, saying it takes money to make money, and it takes excuses to make a Mad Money Machine. Stay subscribed. And by the way, you can reach me at feedback@madmoneymachine. I'll post the fact that I've released this show on my Twitter feed, twitter.com/madmoneymachine. And you can actually call and leave a voicemail, 571-366-7121. Thanks for listening.